Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa! What a fantastic run! He scored!
That's going to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh, he's there!
Kane is the record!
Here's Lucas Moura. Oh, they done it!
I'm loving big engines instead.
Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Hello, welcome to the Tottenham Way podcast. I'm Dan Kilpatrick. I'm here with Tom Barkley and Tom Allnut this afternoon. There's no Marcus, sadly. He's off talking about the tennis somewhere. Hopefully what you've just heard is our jazzy new intro, which we're hoping will get you more in the mood to listen to a podcast about Spurs than the previous intro, which I liked, but someone did remark on Twitter, sounded like they were listening to it through a lavatory, which I thought was a little bit harsh. Talking of sound issues, if you did listen to our last pod, thanks very much, but we're aware that there were kind of some glitches in the background. We were recording it outside in King's Cross. It was a little bit experimental, but we're hoping this afternoon's pod will be back to normal. We can safely blame Marcus for that one. We're going to talk about a few kind of international break issues, Harry Kane's comments on England duty, the performance of James Maddison. Spurs have made another signing, albeit they won't arrive till 2025. So one to look forward to. We'll get into that. And we'll have a little look at the Premier League 23-man squad as well, which should be named this week, as well as the greatest news of the season so far. Scott Munn has a start date and he'll be officially commencing work at Spurs soon enough. So first of all, guys, Harry Kane, he's been speaking extensively on England duty this week, more or less for the first time since he did his unveiling press conference in Bayern. It's caused a bit of a stir on Spurs Twitter from what I've seen, particularly this comment where he was speaking about the pressure of playing at Bayern. And Kane said, "It's definitely a different pressure compared to what I felt at Spurs. Of course, we wanted to win things at Spurs, but if you went a couple of games without winning, then it wasn't a disaster. The feeling at Bayern is that you have to win every game." He goes on to say, "That's part and parcel of being at one of the biggest clubs in the world." Fair enough, Tom Allnut.
I was surprised that he said that. I think just because we've become so used over the years to Kane being quite diplomatic and careful with what he says, particularly with regards to kind of Tottenham's sensibilities. I think whenever a player kind of joins a bigger, in inverted commas, club, this kind of question always comes. I think from a journalistic point of view, we kind of know that it's almost like a kind of, you know, 101 question, really. You know, you sort of ask them, are the demands more? Is this club, you know, a different feel? Is there more pressure? You know, and I guess the angle is a slightly, the idea that they might criticize their kind of former team a little bit. And I'm just surprised that Kane kind of walked into that trap. I mean, Dan, you were there, so you'll know better than me how much he was sort of led into that. But equally, you know, he knows that question's coming. I'm surprised he didn't have a sort of slightly more diplomatic way about it. Equally, I think it kind of speaks to how Kane has sort of moved on, I think, psychologically. You know, I think we have to remember that looking at him from, you know, an English point of view, from a sort of Tottenham point of view particularly, it looks, you know, slightly surprising. But equally, you know, he now plays for Bayern, and for the last 3 or 4 weeks, he's been very much there, thinking about the Bayern fans, the German audience. And he probably in his head is, albeit this was, you know, said on England duty, I suspect he's thinking, how can I, you know, amend myself to the sort of the Bayern side? And this is how he thinks he can do that. You know, he's basically praising his current club. You know, Kane's priority is no longer to sort of be diplomatic to Tottenham fans. But yeah, I was surprised. I was surprised that he said it, because I'm sure he knew almost immediately how it was going to be taken, you know, this side of the water. I mean, what was it like, Dan, in the interview? How did it kind of come about, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, should have said I was in that huddle with Kane. It was in the stadium in Rislaw. It could be pronounced wrong there. Please let me know if it was. Before the England game against Ukraine on Saturday night. And I've got to say that it didn't seem to me at the time that Kane was kind of having a dig at Spurs, really. I think he was answering quite frankly, as he often does. And I think it was maybe one of those interviews where, had the full transcript, including the questions, been published, I think supporters might have looked at it slightly differently. There were a couple of answers, including one about being hurt seeing his England teammates win stuff, which came, it was very directly asked, you know, did it hurt? Were you jealous? How did you feel watching Kyle Walker, for example, go on and win stuff? And he answered frankly that, yeah, of course, there was a bit of jealousy and it hurt. It's not like he was kind of volunteering that information in answer to a completely different question, you know, saying how painful it was at Spurs. So, I take your point. I can understand the frustration of Spurs fans as well. But I didn't feel in the interview that he was kind of going out of his way to sort of aim a dig at Spurs, I've got to say. I guess one thing, just generally speaking, that I would say about Kane is that I don't detect that kind of depth of warmth from him about Tottenham that you get from some other former players. I mean, I don't think he's going to behave in the same way towards Spurs as, say, Van der Vaar or Sandro. You know, someone who leaves the club but always goes out of their way to express kind of how much they love being there and how much they still love the club. That's just not Kane. And in a way, that's a shame, because he's obviously Spurs' greatest goal scorer and maybe greatest ever player. And it would be nice if he kind of had this outpouring of emotion towards Spurs whenever he spoke about them, as, you know, some of the guys I've just mentioned do. But I think he's just too statesmanlike. He's too professional. You know, he's England captain. He's always got this kind of diplomatic head on, and sort of professional head on, and he's never going to gush. And I think Spurs fans kind of pick up on that, which fuels the frustration. I don't know if you think that's fair, Tom Barkley.
I'm not sure it is fair, because I think it's just way too early to say that's what he'll be like. I mean, yes, he often does come across as diplomatic and statesmanlike, as you put it, but those guys, where they talk about Tottenham, it's either after their playing career is finished or basically their career at the top level is over. Kane's, in a way, has obviously gone to the next level, really, at Bayern Munich. So give it a bit of time. The transfer's, you know, still not even a month old, I don't think. And let's see how he talks about it in a couple of years or post his career. I imagine he will still have huge affection for Spurs, and who, we don't know whether he might come back at some point. He obviously left the door open on that front.
Just on that, I mean, what I meant really is also the way Kane has spoken about Spurs when he's been at Spurs as well, like when he's been on England duty and he's kind of spoken about the club. I'm not just talking about in the last couple of weeks or so. I think he's always been someone that will again just be more of a diplomat and not kind of gush. And I don't know. I felt like over the last three or four seasons, he's been a bit cool towards Tottenham.
Isn't that also because it's a kind of a career thing for him? He has to.
Yeah,
this is all part of the career Kane brand, right? Like, I mean, everyone knows what a great player he is, but to him, you know, externally, he thinks, I can't cast myself too much as a Mr. Tottenham man, you know. And whilst he was at Spurs, he probably always had his eye on Manchester City or Man United or whatever, this move that he's now made. And he probably didn't want to kind of alert the whole of Europe to the idea that he was going to be the next, you know, Steven Gerrard or whatever. He, you know, I think he always wanted to make sure that suitors kind of were aware that, yes, he loves Spurs, but he was always, you know, he wanted to win trophies first. And I think, in a way, his message now is kind of consistent with that. You know, I think, you know, okay, he's got his move. But if you put yourself in Kane's shoes right now, he's abroad playing for one of the biggest clubs in the world. You know, he's got a relatively, you know, quite a sceptical audience over there who are thinking, why have we spent so much money on this 30-year-old who would have been free next summer? You know, we should have signed a centre-back and a right-back or whatever that Bayern need. And he has to win them over, you know. I mean, he's obviously won everyone here over. Everyone knows what a brilliant player Kane is. But Kane has to prove himself in Germany. He's got to start again. He's got a clean slate. So I think, in a way, we have to sort of think of him at the moment as a player who has his kind of very much his Bayern head on. You know, he's trying to talk to the German audience rather than talk to Spurs fans. And I think, you know, he could have said it in a slightly different way, perhaps. But I equally just think, yeah, this isn't the time for him to kind of be gushing on about how I love Spurs and what a great club that was. I'll never forget them, yada, 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 because that's not what Bayern fans want to hear. That's not what the German fans want to hear. And I think he's very aware of that.
But he also did suffer the last couple of seasons, particularly last season. I say suffer, it's a bit strong, but as in last season when it was all going pear-shaped, he was there, he was carrying the team through. I think he's earned his right to say his piece, and we should really look at what he's saying a bit more. I mean, Spurs fans might be quite prickly about it, but it's exactly what Conte kept going on about, this sort of fragility and he was talking about selfishness with the players, but this mentality that he's talked about of it just not losing, not being as big a deal. In fact, I remember Conte talking a lot about that in his, when I just first started covering Spurs in that sort of second half of his first season, but when they made the Champions League and it was all going really well, he talked about how he wanted it to hurt when they lost a game, how they'd be sort of depressed for a week. And behind the scenes, you know, he was a really difficult character around the training ground when the team had lost. And he wanted to make that culture the same within the players. And obviously by the end of it, it didn't happen. And Kane's sort of seen all that. And he's seen these winners he's worked under where it hasn't worked out. And that's his honest assessment about it. And I think it might be difficult for Spurs fans to swallow. And it's something that the club are hoping to turn around now with a new manager and going down a different way. But I can sort of understand why he now, no longer being connected to the club, feels like he can speak in a bit more of an open way. And it makes you wonder how many times he did sort of hold his tongue over these years by going into that diplomatic mode. And at least it'll be more interesting if he goes down this path going forward, whether he will or not, I don't know, particularly after this reaction, if he even cares about the reaction that Spurs fans have given him off the back of these particular comments. But I can see almost why he said it as well, because of all he's been through.
I think that's a good point. And it does kind of speak to the comments Kane made toward the end of last season, where he talked about standard slipping and values and the culture at Spurs needing changing. And obviously Postecoglou has come in, and very much his mandate is not just to transform the style and improve results, but to effect a complete cultural reset at Spurs. And I think everyone knows that's what he's trying to do. And I think Kane was referring in part to that, the sense that the whole place had just let standards significantly drop since Pochettino's day, when Spurs were pushing for titles and trophies. I suppose one thing Spurs fans have kind of picked up is this idea that Kane had his opportunities to win trophies at Spurs. You know, it's been pointed out many times, I've seen on Twitter, that since Kane broke through at Spurs, they've been in as many Champions League finals as Bayern, and that Kane had his chance to win two League Cups. He had his opportunities in FA Cup semi-finals, and he individually rarely delivered on those stages. Is there anything to that argument, either of you?
I think there is to a certain extent, because the stats don't lie. He was in those games and he didn't particularly perform that well on the day. But the counter argument to that is probably the main reason they got there in the first place is him. So if there had been one performance in a sort of final, then the argument may fall down a bit. But I can see there's a bit of merit to that.
I mean, the big one was obviously the Champions League final when he wasn't fit, you know, and I think you sort of look back now and you wonder, was it the right call for Pochettino to play Kane in that final when, you know, he clearly wasn't 100%. I think it's a very hindsight thing to say. I don't remember many people at the time saying, let's go into this game, you know, without Kane starting. It seemed to me a very obvious, natural thing to do. And obviously you lose the game and you think, well, we shouldn't have played Harry Kane. But I think at the time you 100% have to start him. It was just an unfortunate, you know, event that he wasn't ready and at his best for that match. I agree with Tom, you know, the idea that you can lay any blame at Kane's door for Tottenham's lack of trophies in the last few years, you know, it seems to me pretty ridiculous, really.
But I would say that as a world-class player, which I think most people think of him as, until he obviously wins something, which is a big part of going to Bayern Munich, but until he performs brilliantly at the, you know, the biggest level possible, and this is more an England thing rather than Spurs, I think, which I'm not really sure, I can't think of a performance in a really, really big game where, you know, there was the possibility to win something was on the line, where he had one of his best games. And until that happens, I think there will always be doubters.
Yeah, I think there's merit to that. And I think on the Champions League final, for me, it was always less about whether Kane should start or not, and more about whether Lucas Moura should also start or not, given what he did in the semi-final. But anyway, we could spend hours on this. Let's talk a little bit about Kane's England teammate and former Spurs teammate, James Maddison. He started for England in the 1-1 draw in Ukraine on Saturday night, was hooked after the hour, after a pretty disappointing performance. I mean, I was there, I thought he started well and then faded, really, in part for me because he wasn't being used in the right way, and in part actually because Kane was dropping into a lot of the same areas, and England's goal actually came because Kane dropped back into midfield and played an incredible pass for Kyle Walker, who scored his first international goal by beating the offside trap and kind of finishing off, again, this brilliant ball from Harry Kane, who had kind of dropped into the type of area that Maddison was supposed to be operating in. I have wondered whether Southgate will or should do what Postecoglou is doing, which is to play him as part of the midfield three. I can't see it, but tonight's friendly against Scotland feels like a great chance to play either him or Phil Foden there. I mean, did either of you keep a close eye on Maddison on Saturday or indeed watch the game? And what did you make of him?
I saw Maddison, I mean, in the game. I just think that, we talked a bit about this, I mean, before the pod the other day, that it feels that he has to, what kind of season does Maddison have for Tottenham for him to be a starter, you know, next summer? I mean, I can't even imagine what he has to do really to get into that team. It feels like Southgate has such loyalties to certain players, one, and two, England have such a wealth of riches in those positions, you know, as kind of creators. And forward players playing it in wide positions. That is, you know, clearly where they have so many good options. I just think Maddison is going to have to do something absolutely extraordinary to even get in the reckoning there. And we've seen how much it took for Grealish, for example, to kind of wrestle his way into kind of Southgate's thinking, because he is a very cautious coach. You know, if we're thinking about the difference between Postecoglou and Southgate, well, it's clear, isn't it? You know, we know that Southgate, okay, he's not perhaps on the kind of Conte end of the spectrum, but he's not far off. You know, he is someone who likes to kind of favour the cautious option over the expansive one, whereas Postecoglou is happy to give Maddison so much freedom, play him in the midfield three. You know, that's clearly a position that he's really reveling in, whereas him being stuck out on the left or on the front of a front three, I think, you're not going to get the best out of him. Equally, there's an interesting thing here, isn't there, with Kane, because I think it felt like Kane was doing so much of the good work that we've seen Maddison do for Spurs, you know, dropping in deep, finding those kind of pockets of space, you know, just behind the kind of opposition midfield. And it makes you think, you know, we all kind of assumed that Kane and Maddison would be a brilliant partnership. And, you know, we saw a glimpse of it in that friendly when they linked up so well. And Kane scored a hat-trick, was it? Or four, I can't remember. Hat-trick, wasn't it? Four, was it? But actually, you know, maybe they would have gotten each other's way. And maybe Kane's departure has really freed up those spaces for Maddison to really do his best work for Spurs. In an England shirt, I think it's going to take a lot for Maddison to get into Southgate's best team. I don't know. What do you think, Tom?
Well, just back to your Kane-Maddison thing, what's quite interesting is that he has actually been playing further forward for Bayern Munich in a more advanced role, hasn't been dropping as deep, which I didn't expect. I was looking at the Bayern wide players like Sané and Koeman and all those kind of players. You'd think a forward that drops further deeper would really play into Bayern's hands. And I think the Sané goal on his debut was like that, but all the questions that Kelly Summers was asking Harry after the game the other day was about some of the questions was about playing further forward for Bayern, how it was different playing for England, like he did the other in that match where he obviously set up Kyle Walker's goal. So that's not to say that he couldn't have actually played like that had he stayed at Tottenham. And maybe they would have dovetailed well, but it doesn't really matter now. We'll never know, and it will never happen. But I mean, just back to Maddison, I think the good, taking it from a positive point of view, is the fact that he's in there. Dan, you just alluded to the fact that Southgate is a very loyal coach, and it's really hard to sort of break in, as James Maddison's probably found harder than anyone. And you know, we were always wondering whether that casino trip back in, was it 2018, when he was supposed to be injured or ill, was it, and how much that affected his chances, because it looked, even from the outside, it looked like there was no obvious reason why he wasn't getting in the squads. And so people kept pointing to that as maybe the reason, but he's finally in there now. And once you are in, it's ironically quite hard, not hard to get out, but he often stays loyal to his players, as we're seeing with Jordan Henderson and Harry Maguire. So the fact that he's in the squad, not only in the squad, but starting in a qualifier, not a friendly, is really positive from Madison's point of view. I don't really understand why you would pick him, to be honest, out left with the other options that England have got out there, as well as he's playing. But I guess from a Spurs point of view, it's just good that he is starting. And I sort of concur with Dan, really. I think that's the best that he can really hope for up until from now until the tournament, which is likely to be Southgate's last one. It feels like he's sticking with his tried and tested method. And for the rest of his tenure, which will likely be after this Euros. So I can't see a big change in system. That would be quite a shock, to be honest, if that was going to happen. So the chances of Madison playing in his favoured number 10 position or number 8 position where he's playing for Spurs, I can only really see that in the last sort of throw of the dice of games, maybe in the last 10 minutes or in extra time. Much more likely he's going to have to, if he's going to start, it's going to be out left probably, which, as I just said, I don't think it really suits him as well. But hey, it's good he's getting in the team.
Yeah, I would love to see Madison or Phil Foden. I really don't mind which, playing that 8 role for England with Rice and Bellingham in midfield. I think it would be so exciting. And then you could play two more direct wide players either side of Kane, which I think suits Kane because he's going to drop, like Saka and Sterling or Rashford more likely. But I don't see it. It's not very Southgate at all. He's going to want someone in there like Phillips or Henderson.
It's funny because fans get really angry about this. Like any, listen to any phone-ins or anything like that. I mean, fans on phone-ins just get angry generally, but particularly about this issue of Southgate not taking the handbrake off. And they must hear journalists who sort of cover the team like you, Dan, or journalists in amongst football like we are, and sounding almost kind of laissez-faire about it. It's only because we just know it's not going to, it's very unlikely that's going to change. So what's the point in even arguing it to death? I mean, maybe he could change, but at this point, I'd be really surprised. So yeah, we'd all love to see it, surely. And you know, you think Declan Rice, Jude Bellingham, I know he's playing further forward for Real Madrid, but he's got the all round game, obviously, and the discipline to play in a deeper role. But if it's no chance of it's going to happen, what's the point in even arguing about it?
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Let's move on. We're not an England pod, and we never will be. We're going to talk about Luka Vukcevic. I'm hoping I've got that right. Spurs' new teenage signing from Hajduk Split. He's expected to join in summer 2025 when he turns 18. I've got to say, I don't know very much about him. He's 6'4", I know that, so he's massive, given he's 16. He's already played for Hajduk. He's already scored for them, so he's their youngest, I think, ever player and scorer. On the whole, I think clearly it's very encouraging that Spurs are signing players before they become superstars and not after, which is always unlikely to happen. It sounds like the club beat competition from City, Real Madrid, a few others for his signature. So on the whole, all very promising, but not really one to get especially animated about for a couple of years at least, but positive signs, Tom Barkley, nonetheless.
Yeah, I was watching a video this morning about him. It's like only a 90-second video with the guy who's presenting. It was very intense, but a lot of information in a short space of time, a lot of videos. I believe he made his debut against Dynamo Zagreb, which is a big derby, I think. So to be able to be thrown in at 16 at any level, but particularly in an intense game like that, speaks volumes really of how he's clearly developed beyond his years. And on that front, he is absolutely massive. I mean, he doesn't look like a 16-year-old. He looks like not only a man's body, but a big man. I mean, 6'4". He's a unit, which is quite rare. Back to Jude Bellingham. I mean, he's obviously someone who was physically developed very quickly as well. But that's obviously exciting. But also his ability on the ball from the few clips that I watched. I mean, it's hard to tell what level he's really playing at. A lot of them didn't seem to be, you know, major games. It might have been more sort of youth level. But his footwork was very impressive. And yeah, but again, 2025, it's so far away. It is hard to get too excited about a player who's just not going to be representing Spurs for a good while. But then sometimes when you look at, you know, you look at Destiny Udogie, and sometimes it's worth the wait, isn't it, really? So I guess we'll just watch him from afar, see how he develops, and hope he can have a similar kind of impact. I mean, the only other thing to add is the fact that Spurs are signing players like this who seems to sort of potentially fit an Ange Postecoglou system. Is this like a sign that they're already, after a month, buying into Ange going forward?
I guess on that, I would say Postecoglou made it very clear the other day, didn't he, that the only signings he wouldn't have a say in would be kind of young players signed for the academy. So I'm not sure whether Vuskovic counts as a kind of player who's going to go into the academy that Ange hasn't had any say over, or whether he's potentially someone that Ange has seen playing in the Croatian top flight and said, we've got to get in the mix for this guy. That would be an interesting question maybe to put to him, assuming he's kind of willing to talk about someone so young. I mean, Tom Allnut, did you have anything more to add? I mean, one thing I will say that perhaps you could touch on is I do just like Spurs buying Croatian players. I feel like Spurs have a good history of signing Croatians. There's obviously Modric, Krenčar, Čorluka, Perisic, of course. Mm.
They're now, I was going to say, can you name the five other Spurs Croatian players who have made an appearance? So you've got Modric, yeah.
Modric, Krenčar, Čorluka, Perisic, and there was a goalkeeper. Was it Pletikosa?
Very good, Dan. Very good.
Yeah. It's a bit like Spurs signing Argentines. I like that as well because it kind of harks back to Villa and Ardiles, and I feel like there's a similar kind of connection there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows that Spurs are kind of looking ahead, which is also refreshing. I mean, for a while, I think they've been very much signing players for the now, you know, and maybe this is, you know, we've seen this already this summer, but the idea that maybe they're kind of going back to a previous policy of signing younger players and looking ahead to the future. So, yeah, obviously a very talented prospect, and let's see, hopefully he can add something in 2 years' time.
So in your Spurs 11 for the 2030-31 season, are you having him and Phillips or him and Dorrington?
Yeah, I'll back Phillips and Lucas.
Doggy and Jed Spence.
Van der Ven signed for Real Madrid by then.
Yeah, excited. Yeah, Van der Ven's gone for a big fee. It's exciting times, I must say. And looking for his sixth consecutive title, of course. Right, on to a bit of admin. This is a bit dry, but Spurs going to name their 25-man, I do apologise, Premier League squad on Wednesday at 2 p.m. I'm not sure there's a huge amount to talk about here because I've crunched the numbers just before we started recording, and I think there aren't really any big decisions to make. Once Lloris is left out, Spurs have 16 homegrown players, which frees them up to, I think, fill the rest with all their over 21 homegrown players. Does anyone have anything more to add on that?
No, not really. You've kind of covered it there. I mean, just what Hugo's going to do, really. I just find it such a bizarre. I've touched on this lots of times, but it's such a bizarre situation for him to be in. Maybe he's just so settled in England. It's going to take a really tempting offer for him. But there's been quite a lot of different situations he could have taken up in this time, and yeah, I guess he's just going to sit it out now. But it's just a bit of a shame the way it's ending, really. I mean, we sort of talked about his final game being a real shame, but now it's just a sort of real long goodbye, and you're sort of wondering when it's going to end.
I mean, we have seen Postecoglou before, haven't we, in other, at his previous clubs, kind of axe experienced veteran players from teams, you know, players who have been kind of considered key to the squads, you know. And maybe this is, you know, Lloris is his example in you know, at Spurs. I mean, it seems a strange one to choose because we all know that Lloris is, you know, certainly not a troublemaker. He's certainly not, you know, a difficult personality to handle, but maybe he thinks that it's important to kind of jettison some of the sort of older heads who feel a bit too comfortable. But I agree. I mean, it would have been nice to have seen Lloris, after everything he's done at Spurs, go out in a slightly smoother and more fitting way.
Has he been doing his badges at all? Because I know, obviously, Poch and you guys have talked about this before, but have always lauded his, obviously, influence in the dressing room, but the way he almost seemed like a sort of, almost like a coach in the way he acted. I mean, that felt like a natural path for him to go down. And if he is doing that kind of thing, maybe that might come into why he's not as bothered by playing time right now. I don't know, Dan, do you know anything about that?
There's an interesting question. I haven't heard that. You're right in saying that Poch, in his book, I think, described him as an auxiliary member of the coaching staff. So that goes way back, it's easy to imagine Lloris becoming either a manager or a kind of centrist politician in France. I'm not sure what he's got lined up, but clearly he's still thinking about playing. None of those moves were right for him, as you said. It feels like he still believes he can be a number one at a big club, and that's perhaps what kept him at Spurs and kept him from making a move over the summer. One more bit of housekeeping. Again, it's a little bit dry, but Scott Munn is finally set to start work as Spurs chief football officer later this month. We believe that his appointment will then coincide with Spurs bringing in a director of football. Postecoglou spoke about that at his last press conference in some detail, and I thought was very, very insightful on the new director of football. He said he wouldn't pick him himself. We wouldn't have a leading say on that appointment. It would be done by the club, presumably by Levy and Munn. But he wanted the director of football to, I think he said, kind of be his eyes and ears and kind of share his vision, obviously, for how he wants the team to play and what players he wants. So that, you know, that feels like a pretty significant appointment who would, you know, take the pressure off Postecoglou in that respect. It's not the way round you'd normally do things. You'd normally have a director of football who appoints the manager, not bring in a manager, then appoint a director of football. But it feels like the new man will probably be primarily kind of involved in player identification and working with Postecoglou on that side.
I think it's going to be interesting to see exactly what his role will be, because you would think for some clubs, the director of football would have quite a few of the responsibilities that Munn himself will presumably be taking on as chief football officer, who's basically Daniel Levy's number two and is now in charge of all sort of football operations within the club. So you would think it would probably be more to do with that kind of thing, like, working with the recruitment department and next players coming in and the general sort of philosophy of what Ange wants to do and bringing it within the whole club. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, they seem to have been, if it's been muddling through this summer without a director of football, they've done it pretty well based on some of the business so far. And it's, you know, it's interesting looking at the players that started at Burnley. Their only son was a player who hadn't been signed in the last couple of years, so it does speak to some of the business they've been doing in the last couple of years. And obviously the other factor has been Fabio Paratici's, you know, still been in a what's the phrase, consultancy role. So how that will, what will happen with him once the new man comes in, you'd expect him that consultancy would be to be over, but I guess we'll wait and see. And as for Munn himself, people who are out in Perth and the rest of the tour, we did physically see him at these games. He has been in attendance at a lot of the matches, and I think most of the Premier League games once as well, as a guest of the club. But it's good that to see him actually be able to start his role properly.
I think there'll always be some sort of residual effect. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone was expecting, you know, Paratici to leave and then suddenly everything would just sort of go back to zero and they would have no targets and no information. You know, obviously these things build up over time, and this summer they were always going to be, I think, fine. They, you know, they had a load of targets and a shortlist for each position kind of there and ready to go. And equally, Paratici was obviously still working with the club to some degree as well. The problems could come further down the line in January next year if they're still kind of, you know, dithering over this process. You know, I think it's, director of football is a very important role in any club these days. You know, it was a long time ago, it was that people were quite skeptical about this position. It's now seen very much as, you know, part of the fabric. And I think the idea that Daniel Levy and Scott Munn could be in charge of kind of Tottenham's transfer business in particular, you know, for any kind of longer period of time, I think is not the kind of thing that how top clubs operate anymore. You know, you look at how Liverpool have been so destabilized by the sort of lack of coherent personalities in these positions in the last year or two, and Spurs have obviously got to get this appointment right, and we expect that will be happening fairly soon.
Yeah, and Postecoglou was insightful on that side of it as well. It's worth digging out his quotes from the last press conference if you're interested in the director of football search. That is all for today. We are hoping we're going to be back for a second pod this midweek where we're going to play Tom Barkley's Spurs draft game. We're each going to kind of do a draft and pick a Spurs team and see who comes out on top. Thanks very much for listening. Please do give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. It really does help us and means a lot. And any feedback, as ever, much appreciated. We will hopefully see you later in this week and for a reaction to the weekend's game. Bye for now.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Lowe's knows when you're looking for reliability, the right brand makes all the difference. And now, Lowe's is the exclusive home improvement retailer for the Whirlpool water treatment line, including their Wi-Fi softener, under-sink filtration system, and more. With Whirlpool's proven performance and our everyday low prices, better tasting, better quality water is within reach. Shop pro-trusted brands like Whirlpool and more, in-store or online. Lowe's. We help you save.